we laugh, but it's on the net, and it's a lot of people in their PJs who give a darn.
And they took us under their wing and have taken care of us.
Food aid arrives in rural villages. Now residents are looking for lasting solutions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 4th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska Natives find an opening in D.C. for their anti-drilling message.
So it's a good feeling. I feel a lot better now. I made it to Eskimo Dance now. I'm so happy I could dance for 2 days.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Groceries and fuel dollars are pouring into rural Alaska from as far away as New York and New Zealand. Village residents say the aid will make a big difference this winter, and they want the new awareness of the crisis to spur a state and even worldwide discussion on long-term economic solutions for the region. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Thousands of pounds of food aid started arriving in Western villages last month. It's come from individuals who pack everything from diapers to spaghetti in small boxes. And it's come from big organizations like the Christian group Samaritan's Purse.
Wanted to bless you guys with this food. Bring it up.
Thank you. I'm gonna help out all right.
On a recent afternoon, pilot Andy Cizik delivered a dozen boxes to Clark's Point, a tiny village on a narrow spit off of Bristol Bay. The weather was especially bad, with small white pellets hitting the plane. So this was a quick stop.
How was the flight?
Oh, just lovely.
All right. You're saying, boy, it's starting to ice or something.
Yeah, we need to get out of here as soon as we can. We don't want to ice up the plane.
On the same day, Cizik also delivered boxes to Pilot Point, where Victoria Briggs met the plane.
I can't say anybody's starving, but I can tell you that people are going without.
Briggs says the flood of support from the outside world has been incredible. She wrote a letter in early February to the Bristol Bay Times explaining the dire situation many families faced in her area. It was a follow-up to similar pleas that came from residents in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Briggs says bloggers picked up the story from there.
We laugh, but it's on the net, and it's a lot of people in their PJs who give a darn. They're just bloggers who caught hold of a story, who packed up, spread the word, and put things in flat rate boxes and said, give us a list and we'll go shopping for you. And they took us under their wing and have taken care of us.
Pilot Point doesn't have a store, so all the groceries arrive by mail at a hefty premium. Fresh fruits and vegetables are hard to come by. Residents usually fill their freezers with wild game, but Briggs says hunters didn't have much success this year.
We exist a lot on a lot of the moose or caribou, and that we got nothing this year. So the freezers are low. You know, they're not empty, but they're very low, and that's very common.
And then there's the price of fuel. Briggs says she spent $22,000 last year to heat and power her 1,000-square-foot home. Many residents make a living commercial fishing, but Briggs says two-thirds of the salmon run didn't materialize last summer. Anne Strongheart is from the village of Nunamiqua. The community is hundreds of miles from Pilot Point on the western edge of the state, but the story is much the same. The fish didn't show up last year.
I only know of one of our 10 fishermen here in the village, commercial fishermen, that actually made a profit last year. Everybody else lost money.
Gas and heating fuel cost more than $7 a gallon in Nunamiqua. Earlier this winter, Strongheart started calling around to check on her neighbors. She says she found it wasn't just her family that was struggling.
I didn't realize how bad it was until I talked to a couple families. Some of the parents were going without so that their kids could eat, and they were very happy that their kids were in school because they knew at least they were getting breakfast and lunch at school.
Now that food aid is arriving and families are filling their cupboards, Strongheart and Briggs are focusing on finding answers to the economic problems plaguing rural Alaska. Briggs says there has to be a way for villages to make it without handouts.
Donations are not the long-term And we realize that. We all realize that. So it's a matter of what we can do to figure this out.
Briggs and Strongheart are teaming up to start an internet dialogue to generate potential solutions for the villages. They have a long list of ideas that includes exploring ways to find better markets for Bristol Bay and Yukon River salmon. They also want to bring grocery stores to every village that needs one, and they'd like to grow more local food. One idea both are resistant to is a concept Governor Sarah Palin brought up at a recent press conference. She encouraged rural Alaskans to consider taking jobs away from their villages.
It requires, in some cases, leaving the village for a short time, perhaps, with seasonal work or with shift work, either on the slope or in mining operations or in the fishery industry. We can help with providing food and providing fuel. But in a cash-based society, there needs to be income also in these communities. There needs to be some economic vitality. The only way that happens is for people to know that there are job opportunities, to get to work, and make sure that that is part of the solution here.
Victoria Briggs says many of the residents who can leave for work already do. But she says it's not an ideal situation for families who then have to struggle with a one-parent household for weeks or months at a time. Ann Strongheart says there are better ways to infuse cash into rural communities.
We're trying to come up with long-term solutions to keep this type of crisis from happening in the future. I really don't agree with telling us to leave our native lands and seek work elsewhere and to just move.
For Strongheart and Briggs, the bottom line is that they want to find a way for every family in rural Alaska to have a shot at making a good living while enjoying their culture and subsistence way of life. They think it's a realistic goal, and they want as many people as possible to join in the discussion on making it a reality. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaskans asked lawmakers to remember children in the state as they debate a $9.7 billion spending bill for next year. The House Finance Committee just wrapped up 2 days of public testimony on the operating budget. Almost $7 billion of the budget would fund state programs and services, as well as public schools and early childhood education. Finance Committee co-chair Mike Hawker says the House proposal is more than $30 million less than current year spending. Each year, Alaskans who depend on certain state programs line up to testify before House and Senate budget writing committees, many concerned that cuts will reduce services. The legislature last year increased education spending, so some of those testifying began by thanking the Finance Committee, then asking for more.
I'm here to thank you and testify in support of the increase to the foundation formula that you agreed upon last year in the Joint Legislative Education Task Force. However, the Finance Committee needs to realize that even with increases, it still translates into cuts in services to most students in Alaska.
Juneau School Board member Andy Story says districts across the state still cannot keep pace with increases in costs related to overhead, energy, and technology. And she says Alaska schools need to pay more to recruit and retrain better teachers.
The number one way to increase student achievement is a skilled teacher.
The budget includes increased funding for early childhood education, which is crucial for success later in life, says Joy Lyon of the Alaska Association for the Education of Young Children.
I read in the paper this morning and was quite shocked that one out of 88 Alaskans is in prison right now. And to me, I look at that number and I think, those are the children who missed 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Those are the kids that slipped through the cracks, that didn't have that strong social-emotional development and the early learning that prepared them to enter school ready to be successful. We're very thankful of the increase to 15% for infant learning, and I just encourage you to go all the way to the 20% increase.
Every session, possible funding reductions in programs that help troubled adults also raise concerns. This year, those testifying say behavioral health grants are even more important as the U.S. plunges deeper into recession.
The fact that people are losing employment and they're losing their houses is causing increased stress, and that portion of it leads to increased domestic violence and sexual assault. And without those services to help women and children in those situations, it's just going to snowball.
The 11-member House Finance Committee expects to take up amendments to the budget early next week and have the bill on the floor for a vote of the full House by the end of the week. Then it goes to the Senate. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Board of Game debates predator control. Northwest Alaska wants better access to subsistence meat.
In most areas right now, they're saying fuel costs are high. We can't afford to get out there. Help us. And we're doing everything we can.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.
President Obama has temporarily halted a Bush administration change to the Endangered Species Act. The president issued a memo yesterday saying federal agencies working on projects that may affect an endangered species will again have to consult with federal scientists before moving forward. In December, the Bush administration said such consultations aren't necessary, but now President Obama has put the Bush policy on hold while the Secretaries of Interior and Commerce review it. Wildlife and environmental groups reacted to the change with enthusiasm, including the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity, Kieran Suckling.
Well, it's the best news we've heard on endangered species in a little over 8 years. And it's wonderful. I can say I've never seen a president in all my years of activism personally take on a endangered species issues like this, solve it with a presidential memo.
Suckling says the restored consultation provision is the most important part of the Endangered Species Act. Governor Sarah Palin is disappointed with the rollback. The director of her Washington, D.C. office, John Katz, says it will bog down the permitting process.
We felt like the original Bush administration rule accomplished the purpose of protecting species under the Endangered Species Act, because we knew that if the scientists felt that there was a significant impact, they would refer the matter to their counterparts at Fish and Wildlife or the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Before the Bush administration left office, it made another change to the Endangered Species Act. It said pollution and global warming cannot be considered when protecting species like the polar bear. Now, Democrats in Congress are trying to undo that. They've attached a rider to a spending bill that would let the White House withdraw the Bush rule within 60 days without having to go through any public comment period or legal challenge. But Republican Lisa Murkowski and Democrat Mark Begich are trying to modify that. They say if the Obama administration does want to pull the rule, it should still be subject to a 60-day public comment period. Senator Murkowski says that's in keeping with the normal process.
That's all we're asking for. That's not a heck of a lot at this point in time. We want to make sure that there is a process in place.
Murkowski has used her appearances at recent Republican events to warn that changing back the Endangered Species Act could slow development and construction projects all over the country. Alaska senators' amendment related to the Endangered Species Act should come up for a vote tomorrow. A group of Alaskans carried a message of no offshore drilling to Washington, D.C. this week. About 20 Inupiat, Yupik, and Gwich'in people traveled from Alaska and Canada's northwest to tell Congress and the Obama administration they don't want drilling in their backyards. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the group found more doors open to them this week than they have in recent years.
The group came as part of a regular effort by environmentalists to bring Alaskans to the nation's capital so their voices can be heard. The Alaska Wilderness League paid for the trip and helped set up meetings with Alaska's senators and representatives of the Environmental Protection Agency and the Interior Department, among others. Doreen Lampe traveled from Barrow. She was elected last month as president of the Inupiat Community of the Arctic Slope, which represents 8 villages. She says their message was clear.
Our hope is that they will listen. We've opposed offshore oil development for 30 years. There's no proven way to clean up an oil spill. It will devastate our way of life, our ocean. It's It's a very fragile ecosystem.
Lampe says she's especially concerned about the hazard of broken ice in the Arctic and the effects seismic testing could have on whales. She points to the Exxon Valdez oil spill and the devastation it caused in Prince William Sound 20 years ago as a reason not to place oil rigs and drilling platforms in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas or Bristol Bay. Earl Kingick agrees. He traveled from Point Hope.
You know, it's good that we all get together and we don't want our ocean to be polluted. We don't want an animal to be lost. Once we lose our way of life, we lose our identity. We are no longer the people we used to be.
Kingick says he also spoke out against drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, including directional drilling. That technique was recently proposed by Alaska senators. Despite having different viewpoints on oil development than Republican Lisa Murkowski and Democrat Mark Begich, Kingick and others say they were glad to meet with the two senators and feel warmly received by them. They did not try to meet with Alaska Congressman Don Young, saying it hadn't proved productive in the past. Kingick has been going to Washington to lobby on behalf of his people for years, but he got a special reception on Tuesday, a meeting with Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. Kingick says he never met with anyone that high up during the Bush administration.
The people of Alaska Native, we are proud of our new president. He is opening the door. He is not having closed doors no more. The department heads have a direct order from the president to work with the tribe. So it's a good feeling. I feel a lot better now. I made it to Eskimo Dance now. I'm so happy I could dance for 2 days.
Doreen Lampe says Secretary Salazar took time to hear from each of them.
He welcomed all of us, and he gave us all a chance to speak on our issues. We have a large group, but he was able to hear us out, and he had some questions for everybody where they're from. He's not very familiar with our large state of Alaska.
Lampe encouraged Salazar to visit Barrow when he comes to Alaska. The Interior Secretary is expected to make a trip north this spring when the department holds hearings about offshore drilling. Lampe wants one of the hearings to be in Barrow, not just in Anchorage as currently planned, since she says it's her home that's at the center of the debate. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Alaska Board of Game meetings continued today in Anchorage. The morning session dealt with proposals for South Central Alaska. Board members grappled with how to control what appears to be a growing brown and black bear population in the Anchorage Eagle River area. One proposal that passed will add an archery season for the Aklutna Lake Recreation Area to try and eliminate a few bears. Concerns were expressed by some board members regarding the danger of a wounded bear laying up near the frequently used trails. This fear was echoed by Defenders of Wildlife Alaska spokesman Wade Willis.
Certainly the high use of the citizens of the Mat-Su and Anchorage area for family biking and hiking and overnight camping in the cabins up there, quite a large campground as well, and the fact that the valley is very steep, so any injured bear would tend to be moving downhill and into the trail system and areas that are heavily used by the public.
Willis acknowledges the need to balance bear populations in areas frequented by humans, but he says if someone has a bad interaction with a wounded bear, it could create a citizen backlash against any hunting in the area. Archery is the only option near Aklutna Lake because of a long-standing agreement between the state and the Aklutna tribe to not allow gun hunting in the popular recreation area. Another decision bans the use of conibear traps for wolverines in Chugach State Park. Board member Bob Bell says the traps crush and suffocate animals and are difficult to open. Dogs have been caught in the traps in the park, and owners were unable to save their pets. Leghold traps will be allowed. They can injure but won't kill a dog and are easier to open. Other proposals dealt with a continuous struggle to manage predators and prey so that neither become out of balance. Bell says Unit 20A south of Fairbanks is a good example. Predator control was so successful that there is now an overabundance of moose.
So we've got a situation where we're authorizing cow hunts to get the moose population down, because if there's too many moose, they overgraze the area. And so there's a point where the predator control needs to stop, because we don't want to eliminate the predators. We just want to control the number of them in relation to the prey species. So we learned a lesson there.
Bell says it's difficult to weigh all the factors and come up with exact answers, especially when an unusually harsh or mild year throws a twist at state biologists. He says in Unit 18 around Bethel, residents asked for predator control after their moose numbers crashed. Residents volunteered to stop hunting for 5 years to help the population recover. It has, and Bell says they now intend to allow a hunt.
So there's an example of the people in rural Alaska saying we're willing to sacrifice to get this resource back to where it needs to be. But generally in most areas right now, particularly northwest Alaska, they're saying fuel costs are high. We can't afford to get out there. Help us. And we're doing everything we can.
Bell says the extension of the moose hunt in the area near Imonik and Kotlik is an example of that help. Wade Willis says Defenders of Wildlife is not opposed to the concept of predator control, but he says the group has a problem with using private citizens who he says may be hunting guides with ulterior motives that skew the numbers. Willis says state fish and game personnel should be conducting the program, and he's happy that there is some movement in that direction. The Board of Game meetings continue until March 9th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Abuse claims from Alaskans who say they were victimized by Jesuit priests might affect the future of colleges in Washington State. Attorneys have begun the long process of adding up the assets and debts of the Oregon province of the Society of Jesus. The Portland-based Jesuit order declared bankruptcy last month in the face of hundreds of suits stemming from the abuse claims, including many from Alaska. But the amount those claimants could receive depend a lot on how the bankruptcy court calculates the assets of the Oregon province. Northwest News Network correspondent Doug Nadvornik looks at the issue of whether the organization owns Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington.
On a chilly weekday afternoon, young men dressed in long-sleeved jerseys and shorts do battle on a muddy Gonzaga University field. The Oregon province bankruptcy is barely a blip on the radar. Senior Peter Zisk has paid some attention. He hopes money from the university won't be rerouted to the Oregon province to pay legal claims.
It would be unfortunate and a wrong use of our resources because this is private donor money and student money and even some revenues that are generated by the university itself.
There's a lot of money at Gonzaga. Just look around campus. The basketball arena opened a few years ago, a new baseball stadium last summer. New dorms and apartment buildings are going up. The university says it received $17 million in gifts last year. So when the Oregon Province of Jesuits declared bankruptcy, university administrators rushed to say the school's assets are not on the table. Gonzaga argues that even though Jesuits run the place, they don't own the place. But John Manley, a Southern California attorney who represents dozens of alleged victims, says, yes, they do own it.
The Gonzaga argument about it's not really part of the Oregon province is like Pontiac arguing it's not really part of General Motors. Yeah, it may be a separate corporation, but it functions as part and parcel of the same organization.
Attorneys for Gonzaga and the Oregon province either didn't return our calls or they referred us to statements on their websites. They will be making their case before federal bankruptcy court Judge Elizabeth Paris in Portland. Watching from the outside will be Willamette University Law School professor Richard Hagedorn.
The most similar case law that might relate here are the Archdiocese bankruptcies.
Those are the Archdiocese bankruptcies in Portland and Spokane. Judge Paris presided in Portland. In that case, she sided with victims' attorneys and ruled the Archdiocese is the legal owner of its parishes. As for the Jesuits, the fate of Gonzaga University and the other institutions may be a long way off. Reorganizing the Oregon province's finances is expected to take months or even years. Victims attorney John Allison of Spokane says outside parties are getting their first look at the Jesuits' holdings.
We're talking about mutual funds, and we're talking about real estate throughout the Northwest in Spokane, in Seattle, and Portland. Some of these properties well over $1 million in value.
Allison represents more than two dozen people who claim priests sexually abused them at an Indian school near Omak, Washington. Morning Mass at St. Aloysius Church. This is the spiritual center of the Gonzaga campus. People here say they're sorry about the sexual abuse scandal, but they're nervous that Jesuit assets are on the table at all. I'm Doug Nadvornik in Spokane.
Six environmental organizations are suing to block logging in an area east of Ketchikan. Costa Lesca's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Orion North, or sea-level timber sale, is at Thorn Arm, near the southeast corner of Revillagigedo Island. Forest Service officials plan to advertise the sale later this month. Ketchikan-based Tongass Conservation Society, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and several other groups filed suit Monday to stop the sale. The Conservation Society's Carol Karen says the region has been logged too much.
This whole area of southern southeast has been hard hit over the 50-year timber contract. And everything has changed in terms of how we value the forest. And the forest standing is much more valuable than the value of the board feet of timber that come out of it.
Karen says the road building and other expenses would cost the Forest Service twice as much as it would earn from the sale. Tonga's supervisor, Forrest Cole, says the initial sale would not cover all costs. That's because it would provide up to 8 million board feet of timber in a sale area designed to provide three times that much. But Cole says later sales could use the same infrastructure and cover expenses.
Additional revenue, depending on what the market situation is at the time, these sales could potentially recoup all the costs that have been generated, but typically they don't. Because of our multiple use mandates, we typically do not recover all the funds that we put into these sales on these larger projects on first entry.
The lawsuit also says logging would damage wildlife habitat, particularly for deer. The Forest Service proposed the sale about 10 years ago. It was one of seven sales blocked by an appeals court order about 5 years later. That order led to changes in the Tongass land management plan. Cole says his agency restarted work on the sale last year by putting road construction out to bid. The timber industry says it needs the sale to keep operating. Owen Graham of the Ketchikan-based Alaska Forest Association says southeast mills are desperately short of logs.
It's a small amount of timber, but it's about the same amount of timber that the Forest Service was able to sell all of last year. I mean, we're desperately short of timber, and that this sale will provide some jobs for a substantial part of the year. If it happened to be bought by the mill in Ketchikan, that would be several months of work for them, and right next door to their mill and handy so they can run back and forth with their barge and keep things going as part of the timber sale program.
Other groups suing to stop the Orion North sale include the Cascadia Wildlands Project, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and the Center for Biological Diversity. In Juneau, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau and Doug Nadvornik in Spokane, Washington. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. Information at 1-888-4-ALASKA. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.